From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a legal look at the involuntary manslaughter charges filed against top state and Flint officials.
I think if it gets to a jury, then the defendants may be in trouble because this is a very emotional, charged issue, and people want to see vengeance done at some level.
President Trump restricts U.S. business and travel with Cuba, while Michigan's farmers worry about losing the lucrative Cuban market for their beans.
We need some Americans down there playing golf and hanging out at their resorts and spending some dollars and allowing them to get in a position to make some money so that they could buy our products.
A possible solution to rising property tax foreclosures in Detroit. Bring in foundations for a grand bargain-style helping hand. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a new idea to attract more workers to the skilled construction trades. Think of it as Pure Michigan for construction jobs.
It started as a logo and as a brand. The state invested into that brand to boost the economy for tourism, and it worked.
But first, President Trump has throttled back on travel and trade with Cuba. His announcement was made to a cheering crowd in Miami last week.
Therefore, effective immediately, I am canceling the last administration's completely one-sided deal with Cuba.
Among the business groups watching that announcement with intense interest, the Michigan Bean Commission, which produces the beans which are a staple of the Cuban diet. Joe Kramer is with us now. He's the executive director of the Michigan Bean Commission. Joe, what was at stake for Michigan's bean growers with the president's announcement last Friday?
Well, the island of Cuba has about 11 million inhabitants that eat beans maybe a couple of times a day. So it's a incredibly attractive market to Michigan bean growers and in fact, U.S. bean growers. So to have that just 90 miles off our shore is just a natural fit for us.
And what did you hear on Friday from the president? I know it's just a few days after the announcement, but do you have a sense of how the Trump-Cuba policy might affect Michigan's bean growers?
Well, we've had an ongoing relationship with the Cuban government that dates back to the mid-90s, where some trade has actually been done, started out as a humanitarian effort. And so we've been really optimistic for many years that if we could figure out a way for the Cuban people to generate some income and be in a position to pay for beans, this is just a great opportunity for us. Friday's announcement feels like it sets us back a bit. But having said that, we've traveled to Cuba numerous times during the embargo on some special permitting out of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and it's been effective. We still need to figure out a way to move from dealing with the Cuban government to dealing with the private sector, and that's not been resolved. And in that particular piece, we probably went backwards on Friday.
Well, it is interesting because the president says he wants to take steps to ensure that investments flow directly to the people as opposed to the government. And I'm wondering if you have hopes that that will also hold true for trade.
Well, we do. We believe that long-term sustainable trade has to be done between the private sector and in both countries, right? So in our case, it started out as a governmental relationship with our private sector. Yeah, that's continued for many years with several different bean-producing regions, but we believe that long-term, we need to get the Cuban people in a position to be able to pay their own bills, and the only way that was going to happen is if we could create some commerce with them through tourism, right? We need some Americans down there playing golf and hanging out at their resorts and spending some dollars and allowing them to get in a position to make some money so that they could buy our products.
And that certainly seems that door has been closed now. When we're hearing it will be organized educational groups that will be allowed for Americans to travel there. I'm wondering what kind of trade Michigan bean growers have had historically up until this point with the Cuban market.
Everything that's been done up until this point was the result of President Clinton opening up that little loophole that allowed for some Michigan beans to flow to Cuba.
And what caused that? What was the source of that?
a hurricane back in the mid-90s that devastated the island and caused the administration at that time to want to care for those people. So there was a little opening for medicine and food, and beans fit the bill. Mostly black beans, some red beans, which are almost native to Michigan. We're the leading producer of black beans in the country. So we jumped on that opportunity. We did the business directly with the Cuban government, the purchasing arm of the government, and business, it went well. But it was very spotty. It wasn't ongoing business by any means. And we were competing with China most of the time, sometimes Argentina, but mostly China. So it wasn't wide margin sales, right? It was pretty tight sales, but it was important for us to get our foot in the door, demonstrate the high quality that we have. Logistically, we're certainly in a position to compete. So that got us started. We made some, began to develop some relationships there.
So, Joe, what happened under President Obama's more relaxed and broader policy with Cuba?
Well, we had the opportunity to travel there more freely. We could, when we got there, our cell phones worked. We had internet service. We had everything that we had here at home. So it was, it just became a very easy place to go, easy place to get to, and we could communicate. Prior to that, we couldn't. So I don't know what's going to happen to those little pieces. Some of the language that I heard on Friday suggested maybe those things would stay in place. So we need a little bit of time to sort out exactly where the Trump administration wants to go with this. The jury's kind of still out for us as to what the total impact of these changes are going to be.
That's what I was wondering, if you see the door still somewhat open or whether you feel it's or fear it has been slammed shut.
Well, as we sit here this morning, right, the first business day after the announcement, we believe that there's still opportunity to travel there under certain permits. We assume that our phones will still work while we're there. We need a little bit of time to probably sort that out. But while we see it as a bit of a setback, we're not sure that it totally shuts the door.
Joe Kramer is the executive director of the Michigan Bean Commission. Joe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The involuntary manslaughter charges announced last week against high-ranking state and former City of Flint health officials, they've made pretty big headlines because such charges are exceptionally rare. Adam Kandub is a MSU professor of law, and he is here with us now. Adam, just how rare is it to see, let's start with a sitting State Department director charged with involuntary manslaughter? Of course, we're referring to Nick Lyon, the director of the Health and Human Services Department.
To be honest, I'm not familiar with a similar charge ever.
So this is really unprecedented.
Right. I'm sure that perhaps, you know, the Top Gun researchers at the Attorney General's office can maybe find a case or two. But certainly within Michigan precedent, this is very unusual.
And then certainly for others charged with involuntary manslaughter, we have former Flint emergency manager Darnell Early, former DEQ water officials Leanne Schechter-Smith and Steve Bush, and then former Flint water chief Howard Croft. So, Adam, what does the state have to do? What does it have to show to win convictions for this felony charge?
Well, so I looked up the website of Attorney General Schuette and to look at the charges, and they're really quite unusual. What they allege is that the government officials failed to act, and that failure to act was grossly negligent and caused the deaths of these individuals. That's a lot to prove. The Attorney General will have to prove that there's a duty to act, and generally a duty to act in such situations involves things like child abusers who beat their children and fail to take them to the hospital, or teachers who discipline their students and fail to get medical attention. Rarely do we find government officials who make a decision about allocation of resources in a different way and therefore have a duty to act because of the incorrect or bad results. So that's a hard thing to prove, to show that there's a duty to act in this way. Second, they'll have to show causation. If you look at the people who had, at least in the press reports, the individuals who unfortunately did die from the Legionnaires' disease, many of them were sick already, and the Attorney General will have to show that but for the failure to act of the various government officials, these individuals would not have died when they did.
Adam, when a case lacks precedent, as you say, this is really very highly unusual, how much higher does it raise the burden of proof on prosecutors?
Well, it's not so much the burden of proof. The question is whether a judge will dismiss the charges before it gets to a jury. So I suspect that right now the defense lawyers are busily writing motions saying, you know, Your Honor, this is not the sort of case that qualifies as involuntary manslaughter. Dismiss the charges before it even gets to a jury. I think if it gets to a jury, then the defendants may be in trouble because this is a very emotional, charged issue, and people want to see vengeance done at some level.
Dr. Eden Wells, of course, the state's chief medical executive, was charged last week with obstruction of justice and lying to a peace officer. So what does the state have to show here?
Well, that she gave incorrect information and therefore, you know, blocked or impeded formal investigation. That's a much lower level of proof and much less serious charge. That is not, that's not the big hurdle for the prosecution here.
Overall, Adam, what do you make of the legal approach that Attorney General Schuette and his team of prosecutors have taken in this latest round of charges in the whole Flint water investigation?
Well, it raises a lot of interesting questions about the role of government. You know, government makes all sorts of decisions that are life and death, that affect the allocation of resources and that can affect people's lives. I mean, how many fire trucks do we send to relieve a fire, a forest fire or a house fire? What are the sort of health precautions we're going to take in various situations? And these often are subtle judgment calls. Sometimes they rise to the level of gross negligence where we want to charge our public officials with manslaughter if things don't go as well. But on the other hand, these are sometimes very difficult balancing decisions, and maybe the criminal law is a pretty blunt instrument to try to hammer out right results.
So it certainly seems like the legal world indeed will have its eye on this as it moves through.
Yes. If I were a government official or bureaucrat, I would be watching this very closely. Because if this goes through, I think that all sort of health officials involved with health and environment will really have this at the back of their minds. Well, if I make my wrong decision here and someone dies, I could go to jail for decades. And that would really change the regulation of these areas.
Adam Kandub, professor of law at Michigan State University. Adam, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope I helped.
Coming up, we hear about the Lullaby Project in Flint, working with young moms to write and record original lullabies for their newborns. That's in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Our infrastructure is our collective ability to say what we care about.
Michigan and other states are increasingly having a hard time finding qualified people to work in construction. Some reasons include increasing pressure for people to get a college education, or the perception that construction careers are dirty, hard, or dangerous. Today's contributor to The Next Idea is challenging that perception, trying to enable people to find careers in construction and to help companies hire them. Brindley Bird is the executive director of the Michigan Construction Foundation. And welcome to The Next Idea, Brindley.
Oh, thank you for having me, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to be on today's show.
Tell me why there is a shortage of skilled construction workers right now.
It's a kind of a twofold issue, and the great news is that Michigan's construction industry is booming of sorts. The housing industry is building as many houses as they've had in almost a decade. The road building industry and infrastructure is looking forward to a sizable influx of new funding to expand their jobs that they do. And the commercial industry is trying to keep up with everything going on, as well as the new construction. There's always all kinds of renovation and maintenance to existing facilities happening that people can't see.
Now, in the past, what led people into construction careers? How did you get your start?
I got my start because my parents told me to get into the truck. My stepfather had a construction company, and we renovated old houses, so that's what we did. That story is true for a lot of folks in the construction industry. They had a family member or a close friend that was in the industry, brought them along, and that's where they sort of ended up. And that's how a lot of people got into it. That's not the case these days. Most people do not run in their backyard and fix old lawnmowers or try to fix their own car. They just don't have that mechanical inclination. So what Michigan Construction is trying to do is, as you said, challenge some of those myths that there are about construction. that it's dead-end job or that it's dangerous. Some of those things are somewhat true. But the fact of the matter is there's great opportunities to be had all throughout the construction industry.
So, as you say, these are largely myths and misperceptions as people think about their thoughts of what it is to work in construction?
Yes, absolutely. I think that was part of the challenge that we had almost 10 years ago when there was some significant efforts put forth specifically on Michigan's construction workforce issues, that idea of what construction was the wrong idea. First question you asked, Cynthia, is why is there a shortage now? One is the perception issue of what construction is compared to college careers, for lack of a better word. The other one was that during the Great Recession, Michigan's construction industry lost hundreds of thousands of workers. So at the time when we were trying to promote a positive image of construction, there literally were no jobs. So how can you say construction is cool when there's no work for you to be participating in? That's what's changed now.
So there is work now.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I mean. Construction is booming in Michigan and in the three main sectors. Housing is doing everything it can to keep up with its demand, so it needs more workers. That's one of the challenges that the home builders released in a report that they put out last week. We cannot build as many houses as we need because we cannot find workers. The road builders are similarly positioned. They're running at maximum capacity at the moment, eagerly anticipating influx of even more funding for infrastructure, which will then make them look for more workers. And as everybody's looking for more workers, the commercial sector is building buildings and renovating buildings, and they are also looking for more workers. So many times we hear from our partners, we cannot take on more work because we can't find more labor.
That's what you're trying to change through this effort called Michigan Construction. Just what is Michigan Construction?
Michigan Construction started in 2015 as an effort to find workers for the concrete industry. It started with the idea that with the Michigan Concrete Association, where they were working with their members trying to place more concrete. Their members were saying, we can work together to find more work out there, but we don't have enough workers to do it, so why are we trying to find more work? Well, that's kind of a strange thing, and it seems like there was a solution out there. So folks at Michigan Concrete Association landed on the idea of branding the industry, and that's what they came up with, was a brand called Michigan Construction. The idea with this was to unite the industry under that brand and promote that brand, thus promoting the industry. The exact corollary here in Michigan is the Pure Michigan campaign. It started as a logo and as a brand. The state invested into that brand to boost the economy for tourism, and it worked, right? Everybody now knows what Pure Michigan is and what that brand represents. They also know that there's a fantastic website to go to get information about tourism. Michigan Construction created a website, created some very cool TV commercials and creative that draws people in. We have a series of three TV commercials that we broadcast throughout the state, advertising folks to come to MichiganConstruction.com and be connected with the many resources that we have, so that if an individual wants to work as a carpenter, we can connect them with training and education programs as well as job opportunities right from our website. That's the core of what Michigan Construction is all about.
And that means many possible types of jobs. I mean, you say you started with concrete, but this is certainly to spread out to encompass many kinds of jobs.
Yeah, we say, Cynthia, we say that the Michigan construction effort is really advocating for the entire construction supply chain, literally from raw materials that are generated right here in our state through to the final project. And every step in between, that's when we think about the construction workforce, we're thinking about every step in between there. Not just all the skilled trade workers that are out there or the construction trades, but the engineers, the architects, the designers, the delivery drivers, the folks that work in the many building material supply houses throughout the state, as well as the inspectors and the testing technicians to make sure that what was built will stay and last forever. So it's the entire construction supply chain that we're excited about. And we think that our commercials represent that, as well as our entire effort. Go to our website, MichiganConstruction.com, and you can see information about many of these careers, as well as the training and education opportunities so that you can then be prepared and qualified to actually get one of these high-paying jobs in the construction industry.
Now, as you referred to the lean times during the Great Recession, economic conditions contribute to ebbs and flows in construction. Do you see a way to help cushion skilled workers from these ebbs and flows?
The first thing is to get the skills. That's how you could. That's make yourself indispensable. There are many ways to do that. One way, of course, is through an apprenticeship program, which is where you learn while you earn. You're on the job working for a construction company or in a construction project, and at the same time you're going to school, developing your skills and getting the qualifications so that you can get more jobs in the future. It's those portable qualifications or certifications that you can take with you that will help ensure you can ride any ebbs and flows in the industry.
What age group do you think it's most crucial to attract to construction?
This is one of our challenges, Cynthia. The age that we need right now is working age, 18 to 24, that can go on a job site today, because the demand for workers today is significant. But we also know something else significant happened in our society, that young people, those that are in 7th grade or 8th grade right now, they have no idea about what construction could be for them because of the previous decade. No one's thinking positively about construction. So Michigan Construction is not only developing and deploying ways to attract workers to the industry today, but we are working with young people in the education system to attract people for tomorrow.
Michigan Construction. Think of it as pure Michigan for construction jobs. And it's put on by the Michigan Construction Foundation. We've been talking to the executive director, Brindley Bird. And again, the website, MichiganConstruction.com. Brindley, thank you so much for sharing all this and being a part of the Next Idea.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. Any chance we get to help build a better Michigan is what we're all about here at Michigan Construction.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
When it comes to building love and connection between mother and baby, it's pretty hard to beat the ancient magic of a lullaby. Those moments holding your baby, singing a lullaby, can live in a mother's heart long after that baby is grown. So imagine the extra power of a lullaby you write just for your baby. That's why a remarkable project in Flint caught our eye. It's the Carnegie Hall Lullaby Project. I recently traveled to Flint to sit down with Joe Deller. He directs the Carnegie Hall Lullaby Project at the Flint School of Performing Arts. And I met Charnice Elbert. She's one of the very first moms to work with the Lullaby Project, producing a lullaby for her baby son, Kaysen. So, Joe, I'm wondering if you can tell us just what you think it is about music and about that lullaby that helps moms and babies build a connection.
Music, first of all, has got an emotional connection. You know, you can say things through music that you can't always say through words necessarily. So I think there's that. Then just the fact that the babies know their mama's voice, right? And it doesn't matter if you sing well or not, but just the fact that you're singing to your baby, it creates a bond.
And tell us how the Flint School of Performing Arts became part of this Carnegie Hall Musical Connections program and this lullaby project.
It was by invitation. Carnegie selected, I think, 15 organizations nationwide, and Flint, just being the area that it is, we were invited to participate.
And what's the mission of the project?
We're trying to capture moments in time. We're trying to create stronger bonds between moms and their babies and just give a chance for moms to create something that they might not have ever been able to create otherwise.
And so, in essence, what are you doing with this project? You're matching moms up with artists?
We have four creative artists that help in the creative process. You probably remember Sylvia and mm-hmm. Quincy. And then we have another guy, Dan, who joined us recently. Usually we work with six moms. That's kind of the number that we've settled on. That's a good number as far as like recording time and all of that. So three or four of us go in and work with six moms, and sometimes it'll be one-on-one, sometimes we'll tag team and help out each other, and somehow or another we get songs created.
Sharnice, here you were one of the first four moms in the first group to be able to help create your own personalized lullaby for your little son, Kasem, who's adorable. I'm wondering, why did you say yes and yeah, I want to do this?
Because to me, music is life and it's inspiring and it relieves stress. And when Kasem was in my stomach, I always used to play music and stuff and my stomach would move. Like, he loves music and it was just a good opportunity for me to do.
So what's the title of the song you wrote for your son?
You Can Count on Me.
And how did it happen? What happened when you were sitting down to work on writing this song?
Well, I just thought about, like, in life, how I always want to be there for him. I just want to express my feelings out in this lullaby so he can really connect. And ever since I played it for him, he loves it.
How did you write it? What was the process like?
Well, me, I'm a very shy person. So I had to come out my shell, and Joe helped me. He was my partner. And working with him, it was very easy because I was like the only pregnant one at the time. I didn't have my baby. So I was really shy. When I came to school, I didn't really communicate with nobody. So this program, like, it really helped me come out of my shell.
So what did you do together, Joe? How did you help bring her out of that shell she describes? Because it's hard to believe.
You know, we were semi-trained by a woman who came out to New York, and there's a booklet that we work with, and the first thing that we have the moms do is write a letter to their baby and the hopes, dreams, what they want to see for them in life, and that's our starting point. And then from there we kind of discover keywords that kind of stick out of that letter and see if we can come up with one or two or, you know, three ideas that can be the main ideas for the song.
So it is a true songwriting coalition.
And this happened to be You Can Count on Me that popped out of the letter, mm-hmm. right? And said, well, let's roll with that.
And then the melody just kind of happens as well?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, Sylvia was helping us. And Sylvia is a genius when it comes to just making up melodies. I don't know how she does it. But she came up with the melody and added a little bit of violin in there, mm-hmm. and before you knew it, we had a tune.
What was it like for you, Sharnice, as you were writing, going through that process, working with Joe, and writing a song for that baby who hadn't been born yet?
It was emotional because at the time, I still couldn't believe I was going to be a mommy. So it was very emotional, and it just inspired me to do different things, and I really want to make one for my daughter, too. So I hope this continues.
In fact, we should note, so your son is how old now?
One.
And your daughter is?
4 months.
There we go. We've got a challenge. You want to do another lullaby? Now, did you picture him in there listening once you wrote it and you had it on a CD, and you would play it, and you played it before you gave birth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you picture him in there listening?
Yeah. He kicks. He moved. But he was just always a hyper baby. He was very, like, I don't know how to really put it, but now that I see him dance off of it now, I can picture him in my stomach dancing off of it.
And when he was born, would you sing the song? Do you sing the song to him?
Yeah.
Could you get a sense that he knew that song?
Because he smiles. He have a little smirk on his face every time he listened to it. I play it most of the time to put him to sleep. But he'd never go to sleep. He'd just stay up and smile and look around.
Would you mind singing your song for us?
Sure. Can I have some music?
Safe and warm.
is Sharonice Elbert singing the song she wrote for her one-year-old son, Case, in a lullaby. She wrote for him through the Lullaby Project at the Flint School of Performing Arts, the Carnegie Hall Lullaby Project. What does it feel like to reaffirm that statement? We're all kind of nervous when we find out we're going to be mamas. You're terrified, like, am I up to this? That message, that you're repeating it for yourself as much as for him, aren't you?
Yes, it feels great to be a mommy. Now that the process is over having them, it feels better and I'm more calm and peace. And in a state of mind, well, that I think, like, I can do this. I'm a mommy. I can do anything. I had a baby. I can do anything. So I'm capable of doing anything.
And you're telling him, I'm always going to be there. Do you find yourself thinking of him one day down the road, singing that song to his own baby?
I know. I can picture it. It's emotional. I try not to think so fast because I don't want him to grow up.
Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome.
Welcome.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Up next, we continue our look at Wayne County tax foreclosures and their impact on Detroit's recovery. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing now with our examination of housing issues in the Detroit area with a look at tax foreclosures. Jerry Paffendorf thinks Wayne County's heavy reliance on late tax payments to balance its once-out-of-whack budget is creating a push to foreclose on homes rather than do all the county can to keep people in their homes. He has another idea. Jerry Paffendorf is CEO of Loveland Technologies, based in Detroit in the San Francisco Bay Area. Loveland works with governments, developers, neighborhood groups, and more, all to gather and present information about property. In Detroit, that has meant battling what it calls a plague of tax foreclosures and trying to keep people in their homes to help battle neighborhood blight. Jerry Paffendorf, welcome.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
First of all, what is your take on the foreclosure problem?
First off, it's ridiculous. One in three properties in Detroit has been tax foreclosed and then auctioned to a random person over the last 15 years, which I think if it was any other city in the country, people would have put the brakes on this thing a long time ago. Unfortunately, we have low expectations for what to expect in Detroit, and that's a shame. And if you think about what that means that property ownership and the equity in owning property was seized from hundreds of thousands of Detroiters, predominantly African-American Detroiters, and transferred to strangers in a massive reshuffling of homeownership. So at a top level, yeah, I think it's a screwed up thing. So where are we right now? As your other guests have discussed, Wayne County has fallen into a sick reliance on the funds from tax foreclosure. To put it very succinctly, Wayne County makes more money when people don't pay their taxes on time than when they do. And if you're in the business of that as a government, you need to get out of that business because it means that you're screwing people over and you're budgeting something that if people understood it, would never fly, ever. And so at the end of this process, if you don't pay your taxes for 3 years, the county treasurer seizes your property, puts it on an online auction, and a stranger buys it. If I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt for why this policy originally started, okay, because, you know, as happens, sometimes things have unintended consequences or side effects. When this policy was put in place, it was because people were leaving the city. And when you leave the city, you leave your property behind, typically. And so vacant homes were taking a long time to be put back into productive reuse. So if you have a process where it takes years and years and years and years to get title from someone who's abandoned it, that's a bad thing. But where we are right now is that it's not vacant properties that are being taken away from people. It's occupied homes make up the majority of the properties that are going into the tax foreclosure auction.
And indeed, you're estimating that probably about 4,000 occupied homes will be sold this fall at the tax foreclosure auction.
That is a number from the treasurer's mouth. They're anticipating auctioning 4,000 occupied homes over the internet to strangers in September. This is not theoretical. This is not something that's going to happen at some indeterminate point in the future. In September, like, where are we at in time right now? Like, less than 3 months, less than a season away, these homes are going to be sold to strangers. From what we know about them, it's a mixture of renters, owner-occupants, people who are on a land contract and getting screwed over by somebody who's pretending to be able to sell them the property but isn't keeping up their end of the bargain, family members whose mother or grandmother used to own the home but has passed away, and they don't even understand how to work with the property taxes. And we know now because our company has followed this issue for years. I'm embarrassed to say how long we've been studying this and nothing has changed. We know that when you put an occupied home up at the tax foreclosure auction, a magical transformation does not happen where somehow a new family slides into the home or the person who buys it is really great to the people that are already living there right now. Those homes tend to go vacant. And when they go vacant, they get scrapped, and then weather gets in, and then they need to be demolished. So Wayne County knows that the auction is not a good thing to do with properties that fall 3 years behind on their taxes. Everyone is passing the buck on a solution because they're making so much damn money from it. And people need to understand that, and it needs to stop this year. We've basically got 3 months in which to decide that we're not going to sell grandma's house to a stranger, and we're going to decide that 4,000 homes is not too many homes to try and understand the situation of what's going on and come up with a better outcome than just throwing the dice and saying, hey, you know, good luck, grandma. This dude from California just bought your house. And now, hey, here comes a guy with an eviction notice next week, which is what happens in too many cases right now.
Now, you've got this idea that could give renters and prior owners a chance to be owners or owners again. And your idea is to turn to foundations, to nonprofits, kind of like a grand bargain?
The simplest thing we can do to turn the tide on tax foreclosure is to change the way the auction works, because the most destructive element of the whole process is when you sell an occupied home to a stranger and then a family leaves. That's when you get the vacant homes. So when you break down the basic mathematics of what the county is trying to do, occupied homes tend to sell for about $6,000 on average at the auction. So if there are 4,000 occupied homes that go into the auction this year, that's about $24 million if you were to purchase all of them. If you remember during the city's bankruptcy, during Detroit's bankruptcy, there was talk about possibly selling the art at the DIA, and people got up in arms about it. And a number of local foundations got together, and they did this thing, which is called the grand bargain, where they put up hundreds of millions of dollars against the art to pay down pensions, to pay off creditors, and protect the city's assets. And it was held up as a massive success, a great use of foundation funds, a very innovative use and a great use. It was successful. We can do the same thing with tax foreclosure. If you can save art, you can save people's homes. If you put together $24 million, put it up against those 4,000 homes, you wouldn't even just be making a donation necessarily, but the process would work where you remove them from the auction. The people that are living in those homes then have a chance to purchase the home back for the cost of the back taxes over time, recouping as much of the $24 million as possible. Maybe you get $24 million back. Maybe you get $12 million back. $12 million is a small price to pay to save even 1,000 homes in the city, let alone the potential for a higher number. So I do think that it's not only the responsibility of the county to stop selling the occupied homes. We need our philanthropic community, the wealth that we have in Southeast Michigan, to step up and recognize that this is the most destructive thing that we have going on in town right now. We have hundreds of millions of dollars pouring into Detroit's neighborhoods. And at the same time as that's happening, people are being foreclosed and their homes are being auctioned hand over fist. Mayor Duggan has said that the thing that you should judge him on is whether or not the population of the city increases under his tenure. First off, that's a bold claim to make. I mean, he's a butt kicker. I'm not knocking him for this. But he should be pissed off at Wayne County because the population of Detroit went down by another 4,000 last year. And the year before that at the tax auction, we auctioned 5,000 occupied homes. So it's difficult to draw straight lines, but would the population of Detroit have increased if we didn't auction the homes containing maybe 15,000 people in them? Yeah, probably. And then if you look at the demolition program, Detroit is spending hundreds of millions of dollars of federal taxpayer funds to tear down dilapidated homes, and we're still minting new vacant homes by the thousands every year through this tax foreclosure process. And people know this. What we need to do is we need to shine a flashlight into what our government is doing and make them say, okay, yeah, I'm going to stop it right now because this is ridiculous. There's too much cognitive dissonance in town right now with the downtown turnaround happening and all the great stuff happening in a lot of portions of Detroit. To have something this blatantly ridiculous and unfair and destructive continuing to happen. And I do think it starts from stopping selling the occupied homes, and there'll be a lot of spillover effects from that. Because when you decide to stop doing that, you need to engage with the people that are in the homes.
Jerry, who are the nonprofits, you know, who in the philanthropic community would step up, has got that available resource, probably money and people, right? Because there'd be a lot of work to handle these thousands of homes.
Presge Foundation, Ford Foundation, Community Foundation of Southeastern Michigan, Skillman Foundation, Dan Gilbert, Rock Ventures. There's a lot of wealth that exists between private companies and particularly the philanthropic community. And the whole reason the philanthropic community, that foundations exist, they're basically allowed to exist because they put money to work for public benefit projects. And if there was ever a public benefit project that needed to happen in Detroit, it would probably be keeping thousands of people in their homes.
How far have you taken this idea? I'm wondering if you have any kind of firm to tentative commitments from any foundations.
I'm basically in a dialogue with the mayor, with the county treasurer, trying to get into a dialogue with County Executive Warren Evans. I'm sending them notes. I'm posting the notes that I get back from them. I just got a note back from the Wayne County Treasurer. Part of the problem is everybody is pointing at someone else for why this problem exists. Mayor Duncan's like, oh, woe is me. It's a state law and the treasurer does what the treasurer has to do. And you talk to the treasurer and the treasurer's like, well, you know, the county executive tells me how I need to spend my money. So, you know, you got to talk to him. And then the county executive's like, well, you got to talk to the state. And then the state's like, well, that's just Detroit being Detroit again. So we're pushing publicly to get the facts out about what's happening. This is like, we have worked on trying to create reform in this for a number of years now. And I'm really losing my faith in Detroit's democracy that this issue still exists. And so our approach right now is to be public and honest about what's happening. And if that doesn't prevent the county from selling thousands of homes in September, then I'm just probably going to give up hope on Detroit because it's too much to hear all the good stuff going on in certain parts of the city and all the great data-driven approaches that the mayor is taking on a number of things, and then to have something this egregious still happening. So we are connected with all the players, and the strategy is to be honest and consistent in talking about it. And I think that the public opinion is firmly on the side of not selling these homes. Once you get it, once you see it, a common argument that I'll often hear, and it's an understandable one, I get it, is that what about the moral hazard? If you don't tax foreclose on people and sell these properties, what incentive do people have to pay their property taxes on time?
Yeah, couldn't this send a message to people, hey, you know what, you don't have to pay your taxes because a charity will cover it for you?
No, you already foreclosed on their home. Their equity is gone. You just don't need to sell them over the internet to strangers because the effect is so demonstrably detrimental. You can see it.
But they wouldn't have been in that position had they paid their taxes.
You got to think off the top, who are these people? Almost half of them are renters that pay money monthly to a landlord, and they're not responsible for their taxes. They're paying money to somebody who's screwing them over and not keeping up their end of the bargain. A lot of the other people who are in owner-occupied property situations genuinely have situations going on in their life where if they were approached in a more proactive, friendlier, more understandable way, which is completely possible for the city and the county to do, would be able to get onto a payment plan and pay their property taxes. But rather than do that, because the county profits from this, again, you heard from Joel in this piece, they make tens and hundreds of millions of dollars when people don't pay their taxes on time. So they're not incentivized to solve this kind of situation. So to look at the person living in the home and put the blame on them and not the government that conducts the process, when you don't have to sell that home after 3 years of not paying taxes, when you know full well what's going to happen to it, the blame should be put onto the people who have the power to do something about it, not vice versa.
Jerry, is this a one-time ask of the foundations the way the Detroit bankruptcy grand bargain was? I mean, what would be the out or the end point for the foundations?
If you want to think about the future, as we all should, unfortunately, anytime you think about the future, too, the story starts getting more complicated. This effort to not sell the homes should be matched by a much more proactive outreach effort that starts immediately, where rather than waiting until like a month before homes are foreclosed and auctioned, which is what the county does almost every year, it's like they decide to go, well, I guess it's time to do triage on the emergency gunshot wound victim that we've known about for quite some time. Homes that are just going delinquent on their taxes should be visited. People should have easier options to get onto monthly payments for their property taxes, not this twice a year nonsense that we have. Basically, Detroiters get like two giant bills every year for the property taxes rather than making it something that people have an easy time paying and being conscious of. Detroit has the most distressed economy and people clearly had the hardest time paying it. Other communities don't have 150,000 tax foreclosures over the last 15 years either. Some of them do. Actually, they tend to be the African-American communities that have all been through emergency management and are headed towards bankruptcy if they haven't been there, have this level of foreclosure, and they all have similar levels of not being serviced as they should be.
But back to the foundations, is this a one-time ask, or is this something that you're looking at year after year?
The problems of Detroit are going to take some time to solve. The foundations are putting money, they all have annual programs, so they put lots of money into the city of Detroit. Neighborhood projects, youth education, property rehab, blight elimination. There should be a portion every year which is set aside to help people pay their taxes on time and to prevent foreclosure. So I think that putting up the money to prevent the sale of the occupied homes could well be a one-time thing. But there needs to be eyeballs on this and dollars going into this next year and the year after, and maybe for the next 5 or 10 years until Detroiters finally are able to pay their property taxes on time to the city, which would prevent this entire thing from happening. It's just that everybody's in such debt. For your audience, we're looking at maybe another 50 or 60 or 70 or 80,000 properties receiving tax foreclosure notifications for 2018 this fall. These are properties that are 2 years or more behind on their property taxes. This problem is not going to be done this year. This has been going on for many years, and every year leadership is like, oh, well, this is the last year in a bad wave. This is the peak, and then it's going to go away. And it's not. People are in debt. They pay 18% interest on the taxes that they're behind on, and so they have a very hard time bailing themselves out of it. The city doesn't make it easy to pay your property taxes. Frankly, I think that's part of the issue is that we've done this for so long in Wayne County and Detroit that sometimes when you stop doing something wrong that you've been doing for a long time, you need to admit that you've had bad behavior, and it's very hard to get justice out of that.
Jerry, over the years, Loveland Technologies has been pretty inclined to work with elected officials in Wayne County and in Detroit on tax foreclosure issues. You now seem to be taking a more critical tone. What's changed?
Do I have permission to speak honestly to the residents of Michigan on our public airwaves?
Please.
Detroit is sort of in a data dark age right now, a hidden data dark age. And by that, I mean, going into the bankruptcy, there was sort of a renaissance of like, let's be honest about what's happening with our problems. Let's show it. And we worked on a project in particular called Motor City Mapping, where we hired Detroit residents. There were about 200 city residents that went out and literally visited every single parcel of property in the city using a mobile application that Loveland built, where you could photograph each parcel and then punch through a menu of options about how the land is being used, if a property is vacant, what the condition of it is there dumping, is there fire damage, et cetera. So it created a parcel-by-parcel picture of the city that had never been seen before. And the notion of that work was to continuously update it so we could see where things were backsliding, so we could see where progress was happening. And frankly, there's a lot of stuff in Detroit that's not improving yet. And I don't think anybody should necessarily be taking the blame for it. It's a really hard problem. But there are more vacant homes today in the city of Detroit than there were 4 years ago when the demolition program started, which has torn down 12,000 homes. And nobody is going to tell you that, that works for the city, that works for the county, that works in the data scene in Detroit, because they're all terrified, because powerful people are saying, don't show that information to people. That could be bad for our business. And I frankly think it's ridiculous. It's cognitive dissonance. I don't know how you can live in a city or be in a democracy that has that much of a sham going on, that people are not honest about these things. So yeah, when you try to stop occupied homes from being sold for like 3 or more years in a row, and you see how ridiculous it is, and you see how detrimental it is to your city, and the people in charge don't do anything about it, at some point you have to leave the party and say, this is wrong. I don't care if I'm blacklisted. You need to stop this now. And if it can't be stopped, then this probably isn't a city worth living in.
Jerry Paffendorf, CEO of Loveland Technologies. Jerry, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks. Somebody is going to win a Pulitzer Prize for putting this story together properly, because it may sound crazy, but it is that destructive to the city that we live in. And it is so in plain sight, but so deep, that when somebody puts it together, people are not going to believe it. So thank you for taking the time to report on it.
And we reached out to Wayne County Treasurer Eric Sibri to discuss the budget issues and efforts that his office is pursuing to help with tax foreclosures. He did not respond to our request for an interview. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, Claire Bryan, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.